Welcome to the Common Good Podcast. We're change agents in the social sectors and business and community and faith meet at the intersections of belonging and imagination and gifts. I'm your host, Troy Bronsink from The Hive in Cincinnati, Ohio. What began as a friendship between John McKnight and Peter Block and Walter Brueggemann has grown now into a fellowship program, 12 weeks with 30 fellows from around the world, working on experiments of imagination and how those intersect with journeying from a world of scarcity to one of abundance. This season is focusing on the work of these fellows and advisors in the program, and today's conversation is with Reverend Damon Lynch III, who's pastor of New Prospect Baptist Church, as well as directing the Summit Center in Rose Lawn neighborhood of Cincinnati, as well as Daniel Hughes, who is pastor of Incline Missional Community located in Price Hill neighborhood of Cincinnati.
I think that faith is this struggle for freedom and justice. We could be much more faithful people, not necessarily religious people, but faithful people who realize that your fight for justice and freedom is your God-given right and identity. If that's being denied you, it's being denied me, or it will be denied me, and therefore we must put this at the forefront. It's not an add-on. This, to me, is essential to life.
Today's conversation is around that intersection of community and small group and agency and how that affects communities in the faith sector. And we begin by hearing from Damon a little bit more about his context.
Our goal is to build community, which we think just incorporates everybody. I'm a disciple of John McKnight, so I believe in people giving and sharing gifts. So we open doors for people to be able to do that as part of our just congregation, but also the larger work we do in community. Mm-hmm. And so we moved from over the Rhine to Rose Lawn maybe 5 years ago to do more than church. When I say more than church, I mean more than worship. So we have this 22-acre campus that allows us to be a village well, and that's one of our goals.
That's a great image.
Because the village well is the place in community where people gather every day, and it's where there's life-giving water. And as you gather to get the life-giving water, you have conversation. How are you? How are you? How's your husband? How are your kids? And then scripturally, so much happened at the village well. I mean, Moses met his wife at the well. Isaac's wife was gotten at the well. Jesus met a woman at the well and turned a whole city around. So our goal is to be that village well for not only Rose Lawn, but just greater Cincinnati.
Brilliant. Brilliant. And you guys have been here how many years?
5 years.
Okay.
Yeah.
And some things have changed in that time.
This place was an old Jewish community center.
Okay.
And it sat empty for 7 years. But it's right in the heart of the city of Cincinnati. And so when our church outgrew Over the Rhine, we didn't have a choice. I mean, we were not going to move to Westchester or Landon or, you know, tear down some trees and build. We knew we were going to stay in the city. So we found 22 acres in the heart of the city with a 4-acre campsite that goes down to the Mill Creek with a baseball field, a gymnasium, indoor walking track, indoor swimming pool. You couldn't beat it. And then we paid little to nothing for it, but it took a labor of love to bring it back online. And we've done that, and we continue to do that every day. There's not been one day in those 5 years where you won't hear a hammer or a saw, because we just have to do it.
I think I hear a diamond cutter like working on concrete somewhere.
Right now, the outdoor Olympic-sized pool was going to cost us $2 million to bring back online, so we couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. But it being there was a hazard, so we've partnered with the Cincinnati Reds, the Cincinnati Zoo, Procter & Gamble, General Electric, Kroger Company, and they are actually redoing our entire site.
Wow.
Yes. So it is awesome. So we've had, you know, partners come on board, so it's been a great work.
Daniel Hughes, tell us a little bit about the adventures of Incline Missional Community.
We're probably the seed of what Damon and New Prospect's doing. We're in our infancy, and we love when we grow up to be able to do that kind of work. I think we've talked about being a missional community rather than a church. We did not want to be a place where people just gathered and people were like-minded and felt good with each other, but they were totally disconnected from the neighborhood. I moved here 4 years ago to lead this campus, this church that was closed down for about 5 years. And so I came in and we started to grow it. But I told them when I got there that I wanted to be a missional community. Had no interest in just having worship. But I do believe that faith is really important to the work we do. I see faith as the struggle or the fight for freedom and justice. Mm-hmm. Like, I think just believing that that's possible. So we do worship. We feel that we should be grounded in a deep faith in God and in that. But that we also take care of one another. So this idea of being a hub where people can come, I like that image of the village well. Mm-hmm. That'll stick with me. Taking care of one another, knowing one another, intentionally going out and building community. For me, I think that the people who come, who gather, who say that Incline is their home, and we're in Price Hill, so mm-hmm. the west side of Cincinnati, and it has this history of racism and separation, segregation. And so in our actual church, we're a diverse congregation, trying to get the people who show up to do more than just show up for what's happening on the stage, but to actually get to know one another and build relationships across races and gender and all that stuff. Yeah. And so we try to, when we show up, intentionally do that so that we can take care of one another. And out of that, we're finding out that people have dreams and stories and ideas, and we're trying to figure out how do we partner with them and help make those things possible. Mm-hmm. And so that's, for us, those are the missional communities, and we don't know what that's going to look like. So we have a young man who came to me, and he was a recovering addict. He had been in jail, and he wanted to help people who were getting out of jail. He had a vision, whether he knew he had a vision or not. Sometimes you need people to help you see what you can't see. See what's in you and see the possibilities. And so we started to build that. And out of that, he said, there's a great need. If we had some resources, I think we could help a lot of guys who are in my situation. I then went to the connections I had and went to the church, basically, and said, listen, we have a young man, told the story, and we need to raise X number of dollars to begin to provide grants for guys getting out and helping to turn their lives around. So while I'm helping, and we're kind of working in this area, kind of getting some fundraising together, he also started a small group, and I was part of it, where those guys who were getting out, we started to just do life with them. So what he and I did, we then were doing that with others. And out of those relationships, we found there were other needs and other possibilities. And so then when we got the guys who were getting out of jail, they would come and be a part of our small group. Not all of them come to our church. Mm-hmm. They may never come on Sunday morning.
Right.
But we're doing life together, and so whatever resources and connections and even issues that we have, we all bring ourselves to the table. That's how we're creating community. That's how that particular community is developing. And so mainly guys in recovery, guys who have been incarcerated, that seems to be the community that we're creating. But then they're starting to make up more of our church, too, which is now changing the way our church shows up, right? And so a lot of those old ideas and people who feel comfortable being together are being challenged by that other kind of person. We're a reflection of Price Hill, I feel. Like we really kind of, we're starting to look like our community.
Powerful. So I'd be curious kind of what contrasts you would draw or what kind of resonates for you in the way that Peter and John in particular talk about small groups and what it is you guys were doing.
Well, like I said, when I took over the church, we decided that if Sunday morning was the time that we had most of our people, then how we show up on Sunday morning and what we do on Sunday morning really says who we are, really says a lot about what we value. So we change what people expected to get on Sunday mornings. 1 week, we'll have a traditional kind of service where, yeah, you will have praise, worship, and all that, and I'll preach. The second week, we'll come together for some worship up front, but then, and we're not in our sanctuary. We actually, because our sanctuary, we have pews, which I wish we didn't, but we have pews. So we actually have to go to our fellowship hall, and we put people around tables. And that's where we started to get people to, you know, and so I actually set our congregation up and said, now, listen, you all assume you know who's sitting beside you because every Sunday morning we come together and you see people, some raising their hands, da da da, and everyone's singing songs and clapping and thinking like, you know, this person's like me. I said, but do not assume that you know how much money they make, the community they live in, whether they're gay or straight, whether they're rich or poor, like went through the whole list. And so people were really open to who they were sitting around the table with. I said, do not assume you know the person and be open to the person. And so just that rhythm started to get our people to open up and say, yeah, like this is us, IMC, but like we're really diverse. Like I don't know who we are. And so trying that practice of getting around those tables, actually embodying that within the congregation, I think is helping us on our kind of Sunday morning or bigger stuff when we're out in the community. I can't assume I know you. I can't assume that I know what your politics are and what you think based on the way you look.
Damon, you transitioned into this kind of stuff. So describe a little bit about what that's been like and where you guys are now with that.
It really came through being a part of Common Good. And I've known Peter and John for a long time and met Walter in the last couple of years. But being part of the fellowship and sitting in so many circles and understanding the power of it, and even though I understood the power of it biblically, when Jesus says, look, I have to feed 5,000 people, let me figure out how to do this. Oh, okay, sit them down in groups. It's like, you know, I mean, they were fairly large circles, but he said, look, we're going to feed 5,000 people. We can't feed 5,000 people. We have to sit them down in 50s and 100s and that's how he told them to do it. And then most churches, you know, there's a popular thing now to have cell groups and small groups and home groups and all that good stuff. And we have that, But I think one of the readings and one of the things I learned from Peter is that they all need to be in the same room. So it's like it's cool to have, you know, your cell groups or small groups, and some are meeting in this part of town and this part of town or this part of the building, but it doesn't really build community. It builds your little small group that you're in of 10 to 12 people, and you get to hang with them every week and drink coffee and get to know each other, but it doesn't build the body. Mm. And so that resonated with me and reading Peter's work. So I decided to do that, as Daniel said, on Sunday morning worship. We went from rows to circles. Mm-hmm. And this is a traditional, well, actually, it's not. It's a Baptist church, but there's not a whole lot traditional about it. But it's next year it'll be a 100-year-old church.
Okay.
And on that Sunday, it was the third Sunday of May.
Man, you look so young.
I know.
It's crazy.
I know. I've been here for 29 of those 100 years, wow, interesting enough. Because our sanctuary is chairs anyway, so we didn't have to move pews, and we sat in circles. And so everybody came in, and I had prepped them. I told them, 2 weeks ahead of time, on this Sunday, we're going to be sitting in circles and not rows. We're going to get to know each other. And it was so powerful just to hear. I mean, so, and then, of course, Peter talks about the power of the questions. Mm-hmm. So what I had them first do was meet somebody you don't know. Then we talked about it. I said, I need 4 or 5 people to come up and tell me who you met and tell me something about them. Like 20 people came up.
Yeah.
I asked for 4 or 5, but 20 people came up. I met this person, and I sit behind her every Sunday, and I didn't know her name. But we just met for the first time this day, even though they've been sitting next to each other for months, if not years. One lady said, I've been a member of this church for 20 years, and I only know 2 people.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, it was crazy. And so, I mean, it was those kind of stories. And so then the next question they wrestled with was, why was it important for you to be here today? And that's when it gets heart-wrenching. You know, the depression I'm going through, my marriage is falling apart, my kids. So it wasn't just important for me to be here today to praise God. It was important for me to be here today because there's some real things I'm wrestling with in my life.
Here's Pastor Lynch setting up that kind of shift of conversation with his congregation on that first Sunday.
What matters most in the body of Christ is that we love one another. And in order to love one another, we need to get to know one another. We could have come in here today like we have for the last 28 years, 29 years I've been here, and lined up in rows and waited for the choir to inspire and for me to inspire and leave here and never have had the experience we just had. We can do that week after week after week after year after year after year and still be in a place where we feel lonely. I do this today because I love you. Plain and simple. That was the first time we did it, and we just did it this past Sunday.
Okay.
And it was even more powerful than the first time. Just the stories and watching people light up. And somebody challenged me this week. They said, was I in a small group? Was I in one of the circles? And I wasn't, because I was like, quote unquote, facilitating. But what I was doing was enjoying it. Because you could hear this cacophony of voices in the room. And to me, that's a lot more powerful than being in your small group somewhere across town. And then I just love the seating arrangement, as opposed to the rows where everybody's focused on the stage, where you get your normal, I call it a concert and a TED Talk.
Mm-hmm.
To me, that's basically, a little spirituality. It's a concert and a TED Talk. You know, somebody gives a 20, 25-minute talk. Somebody sings 3 or 4 songs, and, you know, we lift an offering and we go home. So it's been powerful. Now, after 29 years of being here, it gives me stronger reason to stay.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Say more about that.
I can't speak for every pastor, but I know most of the pastors I know, like, we quit every other day. I mean, we do. It's like, all right, I'm done. I'm done. And then, you know, God gives us a reason to stay, you know, because it's stressful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I love everybody here, but it's a lot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, this thing gets overwhelming. So being able to watch them, though, grow together in these circles, it almost takes me out of it.
Ah.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's like, you don't need me. You know? Mm-hmm, they're finding each other. So it was beautiful.
Yeah. You're nodding, Daniel.
Oh, I totally agree. That notion of not being in the center of it all and the possibilities of that and sort of being reignited. Like, I've been sort of pastoring in, like, 99. I totally agree. You want to die. Like, you want to quit so often. And this is breathing new life. It's like, can these dry bones live? And this tells me, and so this is confirmation, like you're confirming what I'm feeling, because sometimes you feel like you're, again, all alone. And
mm-hmm. Do you think there's something, what I think I hear you saying a little bit is that the energy was heavily dependent on you. Mm-hmm. And then does this mode shift that energy? And I'd even be interested here to kind of open the conversation towards folks that are in other occupations and vocations. What is it like to turn the vision energy back over to a community through these techniques and tools and structures?
I think it's important. Of course, it's powerful. When I announced the first time we did it, and I gave a 2-week announcement, one of the members of our congregation said, you know, I don't think I'm going to like this. She said, I don't want to talk to people. I come to hear a sermon. I'm like, that's the problem. and not only is that a problem, it's like every week I have to be fresh. Every week I've got to be like on point and on stage. And that's a lot of pressure.
Yeah.
And it's not that we don't do it. We do. But I don't think anybody understands that but other people who have to do it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Every week. And I think what Daniel and I have both learned, though, is what people are seeking is community. Mm-hmm. And in our Common Good Fellowship, at least the two times that we all came together, mm-hmm. It was interesting because both times we were in buildings that used to be active churches.
That's right, yeah.
And they are now places that build community. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. With the church, and the second church we were in is one that I had preached in before. It was New Sardis Primitive Baptist Church, and now it's called the Monastery.
Yeah.
2 weeks later, the gentleman who used to pastor there, whose father also pastors, sold his church because it's gone, and somebody else bought it to build community.
There we go.
And so that ought to be a wake-up call to the body of Christ, right, that's what people are looking for. Yeah.
And that even the buildings can function in that way. A lot of people complain about being stuck with their building. But right, it's not the building that's the
obstacle. Right. The building's not the problem.
Do you have a CDC? Right. So then you can do all kinds of work there and build. The church can actually build community because you don't have to. You don't have that financial responsibility necessarily to support all this. You can bring in different streams of revenue, and so you can actually focus on community building. And I think that model's helpful. I mean, I think churches need to really rethink the way that they, the way they're thinking about funding their group, their organization.
Mm-hmm. Say a little bit about that. Yeah.
Even in wealthy communities, right? So even the biggest church, the vision that they actually have, you really can't get that from your congregation. Because, right, so if you're on TV and you're doing all these things, you still need to pull from other resources. And so your pastors are writing books. So there are all kinds of other ways. But I think we force smaller churches and medium-sized churches to try to squeeze all of that money out of the people, and it's just not there. Mm-hmm. Not for what you really want to do.
Right. Right, that's true.
That's right. You know, well, say a little bit then about that CDC work.
Well,
when did you form the Community Development Corporation?
Long time ago.
Okay.
Yeah, when we were in Over the Rhine, we formed it. Some I don't know, I think I started in 1990 at the height of the crack cocaine epidemic in America, and it hit Over the Rhine hard. And you have to understand, I didn't grow up in Over the Rhine. I grew up in like North Avondale. And so God then puts me in a church, an OTR. So I'm not somebody who says, hey, I grew up on Findlay Market selling shopping bags.
Yeah.
That's not my experience.
You know,
exactly. So now I'm down here in OTR, and it's the height of the crack cocaine epidemic, and I'm watching families fall apart. I'm watching people die. I'm watching people come into our church, and, I mean, their lips are burned here, and their fingers are burned. So I'm like, well, what is going on? Well, at that time, you would break somebody's antenna off of their car. Cars had those antennas, and you would break the antenna off and use that to smoke the crack. And, of course, it gets hot, and it burns your lips. It burns your hands. And I tried to figure out how do we save these people, because I believed that crack was from the pits of hell. it was like almost nothing that we could do was turning people's lives around from crack cocaine addiction. Also, we just determined that one of the things we have to do is we've got to, you know, own the property, because the property was, you know, there were slumlords and people doing crazy things. So we formed the CDC to start buying up the property and putting, you know, positive things into it. And also so we wouldn't be surrounded by negative things, because we didn't own the property. We did a lot of great stuff that we're extremely proud of. And I was 23 years in OTR. And it's crazy because I say that as almost if I spent 23 years in OTR. It's like, you know, yeah, like I served my time. Went through the riots, went through the police shootings. I watched people die in the street. I literally, right by our church, I watched three guys die laying on top of each other. Three young men. Somebody drove by, shot them all. And we literally just watched them die, take their last breath. So many memories, but most of them are good, because it was a community of good people trying to raise their families and raise their kids. Mm-hmm. Our CDC was important because it allowed us to open up a bakery. It allowed us to open up businesses. It allowed us to employ people, mm-hmm. because that's part of the thing that gets people, you know, out of the situation they're in. And we still have the CDC today.
Tell the story of when you decided that this property would have a different name than New Prospect Church.
Day one. Yeah. It's called the Summit Center. And so when you drive up, that's the sign up above the place, because I did that for the members of our congregation more so than the community. Mm-hmm. I needed the members of our congregation to think bigger and outside of just being New Prospect Baptist Church. Mm-hmm. I think they get it, most of them. There was no vote. They just came up one day and it said Summit Center. No one questioned it. It just makes sense. Yeah, we're on Summit. This used to be the Jewish Community Center. It's now the Summit Center, which means that it's a community. It's a place for community. The building, it lends itself to that. And the fact that Roselawn is one of the few communities in the city of Cincinnati that doesn't have a rec center. Everybody else has a rec center. Roselawn doesn't, because this was it. So if we're going to revitalize, let's put back what was for the benefit of the community.
That's probably been a factor for why you can partner with the Reds and
right.
GE.
Yeah, they're not so much partnering with the New Prospect Baptist Church.
Yeah.
They're partnering with the Summit Center.
I'm curious, as the Common Good Fellowship is kind of being developed, and this is we're rounding up week 12, what do you think is possible that we haven't explored yet with this work, or what would you kind of invite folks to consider as this keeps iterating? Where do you think this could go?
Yeah, I think what we have not or did not explore was the concept of justice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when I see what's happening on the border, when I see these kids being taken from their parents, I think that's something that I don't believe we really dealt with. Mm-hmm. So that would be important to me. I think we kind of just either went around it or above it, or we just watched over it. I mean, hospitality, generosity, and forgiveness are powerful, but there's also the need for justice.
Mm-hmm. Say a little more there in terms of justice that we, if we kind of use some of Peter and John's language about citizenship instead of deferring it to systems, mm-hmm. where you see that connection?
Well, it then becomes mobilizing people to stand up for things that they believe in, mm-hmm. mobilizing people to fight for the disenfranchised. You know, I totally agree with empowering, and but sometimes somebody has to stand in the gap.
Mm. Yep.
For those who can't stand for themselves, mm-hmm. and I think our group understands that. The fellowship that I'm a part of, mm-hmm. and I would love to have, you know, when you have a Walter Brueggemann and a John McKnight and a Peter Block in a room, I would love for them to talk on that, because I believe each of them would bring an awesome perspective to it that would benefit us who are out here fighting for justice.
That's good. Thank you. Yeah. No.
I think their voices would lend a lot.
Yeah, I think I would agree that justice piece. And it seemed like at our first session that we were kind of, some of that was starting to come up, but it didn't seem like that was part of the agenda when people would ask questions about who's in the room and why and how. And I think that as I think about justice, it's the intersection between truth and love. That it's those two kind of intention, if you will. It can't be all just love and encouraging and even notions of empowerment. That needs to be there, but that just ends up being just sentimentality, right? That just ends up being just almost sometimes feeling sorry for someone. But you need that truth telling. There has to be, why can't we get along? So love says, well, can't we all get along? Wouldn't it be great if we all got along? Yes, but then truth tells us why we can't get along. Right. Mm. And to me, that's what justice is, working those two things. And we didn't do that. We're not getting at the messiness of this justice work. And as I said before, I think that faith is this struggle for freedom and justice. I think we could be much more faithful people, not necessarily religious people, but faithful people who realize that your fight for justice and freedom is important. It's your God-given right and identity. And if that's being denied you, it's being denied me, or it will be denied me. And therefore, we must put this at the forefront. It's not something, it's not an add-on. Mm-hmm. This, to me, is essential to life. We're being invited to put our faith in systems that are not going to bring about freedom or justice, but that it's actually in us. You know what you need. You know your story. You know how you've been disenfranchised. And then that whole mobilizing, I like that, just mobilizing people for that, for mm-hmm. that kind of work. So I think the common good could carry that agenda.
I think it should. Yeah.
Bree Newsom is the daughter of the former head of the Freedom Center here in Cincinnati.
And she's the lady.
She's the one who climbed the flagpole in South Carolina and brought down the Confederate flag. And we still need people willing to climb the flagpole.
This has been the Common Good Podcast, conversations at the intersection of place and belonging and remembering. You can learn more about the work of Peter, John, and Walter. You can learn more about Daniel and Damon's work, as well as the future of Common Good and the Daily Food for Thought at commongood.cc. So stay tuned there to hear about what's next. Common Good is a collaborative production of The Hive, a center for contemplation, art, and action, and Common Change, eliminating personal economic isolation. We're produced by myself, Troy Bronsink, and Joey Taylor, and our theme music is written and produced by Jeff Gorman. Now, normally we end this with a little tongue-in-cheek chance to laugh together, but we just closed up the end of 12 weeks, and John McKnight had some words to share with all the fellows, and we thought we would leave with that charge.
I remember years ago, Damon had given a sermon, a New Year's sermon, and he sent a tape of it to me, and it's just beautiful. I play it every year. But a part of it says, he's talking about, why would you be fearful? And he says, why would you be fearful when you are surrounded by angels? You are surrounded by angels. You are protected by angels. And so as I look at each of you, I wonder whether or not that's what's happened. The angels have come to surround you. And the reason that I think that's so important is because, at least in my experience, if you don't have the vision that is the common commercial consumer culture vision, you're liable to be lonely and uninfluential. So what is it that will protect you? And it's all those angels around you. You are the people who can protect each other's vision and help make it manifest. So finally, I hope you become a band of angels through time, in which you protect each other, learn from each other, and do your part in making each of your dreams come true. And if you do that, when you're my age, I can just assure you, you will be satisfied, because your dreams will have come true.